I work in comparative literature and translation. And when you work in comparative literature, it means that you are investigating trends and tendencies in literature that move across between languages, between cultures. You look at themes, ideas, patterns, forms that move. In some cases, they don't move, and the fact that they don't move is another interesting thing. But you're basically looking at literary processes in movement. And every so often, things happen in literary history where there is an enormous shift of perception, a huge, huge cultural shift. And when I was putting together these notes, I thought probably one of the best examples of this is in the 18th century, where you have the invention of the sublime. And all of a sudden, people see the world differently. So that 17th century travelers, for example, in Italy, see hideous mountains, the horrible volcanoes of Sicily and Naples. It's ugly, it's terrifying, it's something to be shunned. And by the beginning of the 19th century, these are places of pilgrimage, because they become beautiful through their grandeur, through their sight. The whole concept of what constitutes physical landscape beauty changes. And I would want to echo what Andrew's saying, in that I think an absolute major, major theme and interest in writers in the latter part of the 20th and the 21st century is memory. I think it has taken over, if you like, from what I would call the focus on the unconscious, which dominates the first part of the 20th century. And I jotted down a little list of examples of why I would want to stand here and say that I think memory is so significant. You might note the enormous popularity of biography and autobiography as a genre. Bookshops now have whole sections on biography. Biography is in bestseller lists in countries all over the world. Linked to that, you've got the emergence of something that is not quite autobiography, but calls itself life writing. And just as memory studies has emerged as a new interdisciplinary field, so life writing is a new field. And a field in which a number of writers are writing out of their life experience, but not actually writing their lives, if you see the difference. There's a difference between life writing. You might think of the enormous global success of Chinese women writers. Maxine Hong Kingston, one of the first people coming up in the 1970s. You could almost say that this has become a kind of genre in its own right, that is North American Chinese women novelists writing about their transcultural experiences, remembering, repeating memories. There's a fascination at the moment in detective fiction with memory. You could say, well, this has always been important. The notion of uncovering something in detective fiction is important. But there is a kind of, let's call it an almost subcategory of detective fiction, which is the forensic fiction. And this, of course, also very much in the media. Think of the number of films, the number of TV series that are about forensic, cold cases, digging things up, going back, looking into the past, remembering, exploring crimes from time past. And when, about 5 years ago, I was a judge on the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize, and I was absolutely amazed by how many novels we were reading in translation from all over Europe, which had as their dominant theme a crime and the discovery of the crime, the uncovering of the crime exposed a secret. Very often a secret connected with the Second World War. A secret connected, a lot of Spanish writers, for example, where the secrets go back into the Franco period or go back to the Spanish Civil War. So there's a kind of fascinating, I think, use of popular fiction, and particularly of detective fiction, at the moment, or over the last sort of 20, 30 years, to uncover, to remember. Just a little quote from the great literary critic Geoffrey Hartman. who reminds us of the enormous importance of continuing to study memory and to think about memory. Even the dead, says Hartmann, are not safe from the victors, who consider public memory part of the spoils and do not hesitate to rewrite history. And Hartmann here, of course, is urging writers not to allow the public memory, the victors, to take over the public memory, but through writing to explore memory in different ways. There's also, which interests me particularly, a lot of writers. We gave an honorary degree to Eva Hoffman here last summer. She's a classic example. Writers writing out of their remembered experiences of more than one culture. And again, you might think, anyone here interested in post-colonial writing, the extent to which memory, remembering, crossing boundaries is hugely significant. Some of you may know the very fine poetry of the Anglo-Pakistani poet Moni Zaralvi, and her first collection, which won awards, was called The Country at My Shoulder. An English woman with a country behind her, a remembered country, which is Pakistan. So what's my work in at the moment? Well, I'm doing two things on memory. I'm working on translation as memory, the notion that when you translate, you somehow remember. And I've been commissioned to write a memoir, which I'm doing, which is proving to be a very interesting experience, because a memoir is not an autobiography, and so it's not one of those that begins, I was born on the first Tuesday of the month in whatever. And I'm going to sort of come on to the memoir thing in a moment, but I just want briefly to start out by looking at translation. Because translation is a curious literary phenomenon in that it always involves an absence and a presence. The translation is happening in the now, but there is, in any translation, the memory of the original from which the translation has been made. Something is written, and then it's translated into another language. And if it wasn't written somewhere else in the first place, then the translation would not be a translation. So there's an inevitable process of, if you like, travel from the original to the translation, and there's also an inevitable process of remembering. So I would argue that translation is effectively an act of memory, because what the translator does is to read something, to then reformulate it in another way, in another language. And that reformulation involves both a creative act, it's rewriting, and a remembering. And of course, the great Walter Benjamin in the 1920s talks about translation ensuring the survival of a text. When you translate something, it ensures that it survives. It's it gives a new life to a dead writer. And you might just want to think how many people in this room could read Homer and any of the ancient Greek writers who are reworked, reread, reperformed so many times if we hadn't had translation. You could say that they exist. They continue to live. They are remembered through translation. Andrew talked about a memory boom. I agree entirely there's a memory boom, but there's also something at this moment which is a translation boom. It was a huge translation boom. And you could say, okay, there's always been translation, and there has. But the extent to which translation is of significance now, at this moment in the 21st century, I think is unique. The German critic Doris Bachmann-Medick has actually talked about what she calls the translational turn in literary studies. She's arguing that literature now increasingly involves translation of some form. And you can see why, I suppose, when you think of how many millions and millions of people there are in movement around the planet at this time. Some dispossessed through wars and famine and exiled for all kinds of reasons, others moving in search of work. But there's a mass movement of peoples, and that mass movement of peoples involves forms of translation as people move between cultures, between languages. And so what's happening in the field of translation when we start to think about translation and memory is that memory is linked, the memory and the translation, linguistically also to questions of identity. And this, I think, is what writers are continually exploring. Another reason why memory is so important. As you move from one culture to another, as you write about the remembered other culture, so there are big issues here about identity. And there's a growing body, in fact, of what I would call hybrid works, novels, plays, poems, that are emerging out of multiple histories. A number of writers actually using more than one language in the texts that they write. Now, I said before I was doing a memoir, I've always believed that it's important, since I work in translation, it's very important to do translating. It's also, I think, as a literary critic, important to write, to have the practical dimension. And the memoir has been an absolutely fascinating experience. It's made me think very, very hard about, not only about writing, obviously, but also thinking about remembering, about memory. And I did notice, looking on the board earlier, one of the questions is whether people's memories are their own. And I put that question there because part of working on the memoir has been the fascinating discovery within my own family of how many of my memories are either borrowed by my children and told as though they were their memories, or how many memories I've borrowed. And I was telling someone, I think I was telling one of my daughters something the other week, and she said, "Mum, that didn't happen to you, that happened to me. I told you that, but I was remembering it." And I think in any community, in a family or any other community, this sharing and swapping of memories is enormously important. There's also the interesting question when you're writing, did you remember it? Did you dream it? Andrew talks about the enormous significance of the media, of television. Well, yes, you know, what did you see? What do you think you remember? Now, I've structured this memoir of mine, not wanting to be chronological, I've structured it around a place. I've structured it around the city where I spent my childhood, which is Lisbon, and I've tried to sort of build it around a going back. And I was enormously helped in about 3 years ago, when I first embarked on this project, by the fact that in November 2005, there was the 250th anniversary of the great Lisbon earthquake of 1755. An event so traumatic, so enormous, I think you could probably compare it to the 9/11 of the day, that it's the inspiration for Voltaire's Candide, and it created huge repercussions right across Europe, the Lisbon earthquake. It challenged both it challenged religious orders right across. It challenged those who were questioning the existence of God. It was an astonishing phenomenon. And so I was having to write about the Lisbon earthquake for a couple of volumes that had been commissioned to write for back in Lisbon. And I was going back to Lisbon. And I was thinking about this thing, and all of this sort of started to come together. And built into, of course, just before I say that, The other thing that happened is that as I began to write the first of those essays, and as I was simultaneously writing sections of the memoir, the appalling tsunami in the Indian Ocean happened. And it happened, if you remember, just before Christmas, December 2004. And so I had past, and I had present, and I had my own past, and I had a rethinking of the 18th century, and I was trying to put all of this thought together. So what I'm going to do, really, to conclude after these rather random thoughts, I'm going to just read you a little bit from a piece that came out last year and is about memory and about earthquakes. And I think this perhaps will show you maybe the better than I can do by simply talking to you about structuring a memoir and some of the difficulties of trying to find kind of the right echo. And it's also an experience here that I suspect some people in this room have probably had themselves. It is a piece about going back to Lisbon for the first time in 35 years. I went back. And when I was on the plane going back, I discovered to my absolute amazement that the English Cemetery in Lisbon, which is a place where I used to play, was where Henry Fielding was buried. And of course, when I was a child, I'd never even heard of Henry Fielding. And so I went back to the cemetery to look for Henry Fielding's grave, but also to go back into this huge, rambling, enormous place full of these decaying graves. I went to the English cemetery the next day. You have to ring a bell and wait to be admitted. Once the great gates opened, there before me was the avenue of cypress trees leading to the church. And as I walked in, the old familiar smell hit me instantly, the smell of boxwood and thyme and unhindered vegetation. I looked around and found to my amazement that I could see from end to end of what was a very small area. I had grown so tall, I could now see over the tops of most of the gravestones. The vast space of the English Cemetery of Memory had shrunk to the size of a large garden. I felt like Alice when she drinks the medicine and suddenly finds herself looking down on the world she once inhabited. The tiny English cemetery of the 1990s was no longer the great mysterious playing space, the world of labyrinthine paths and great stone monuments and secret corners of childhood. Memory was deceitful. Memories of place and space had come from the child's perceptions, and the adult found herself in a new environment that only distantly and through the sense of smell primarily, a Proustian echo related to the remembered location.